content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 29/April 5, 2021. As usual, the cover is banded in red all around the border. Time, in large, bold-faced type, is in white, superimposed on a very colorful portrait of the face of a woman. Her hair is long and black. Her skin is actually tritoned, according to this artist's work. It's in tones of tan, pale tan to reddish tan. She's surrounded by a purple background, light purple, one might say lavender, certainly not orchid, though it's not pink enough, and flowers, bright flowers, white blossoms like apple blossoms and yellow blooms like dahlias and some stylized pink blooms, too. Perhaps they're intended to be peonies. There's an acknowledgement here of the cover art from within the Time magazine. My hope is to see the beauty of our people reflected in the colors of our communities in a dignified and respectful way. Amanda Feng Bodipakaya, an artist based in Brooklyn, says of the image on the Time cover. Her artwork, which she sees as a portrait of the Asian American community's beauty and resilience amid a rise in anti-Asian attacks during the COVID-19 pandemic, was initially created for the New York City Commission on Human Rights 2020 Public Art Series. She says, "I still believe in our city." The headline above the large Time print is, "We Are Not Silent, Confronting America's Legacy of Anti-Asian Violence." Beginning now with For the Record, "Every day has been March the 13th since it happened," says Tamika Palmer, Breonna Taylor's mother, in an interview with The Cut, published March 12 to mark the first anniversary of her daughter's killing by Louisville, Kentucky police officers. "The military put you in prison because they are afraid of you. They cannot arrest your body. Excuse me, they can arrest your body. They cannot arrest your spirit." From Bo Ki, KYI, co-founder of a Myanmar human rights organization, in a March 11 interview with Time discussing protesters who were beaten, arrested, and in many instances killed during crackdowns since a military coup. 12,155, the number of cold, stunned sea turtles found off the coast of Texas during February's record-breaking snowstorms, per NPR. More than 4,000 have been safely released back into the wild. In authoritarian states, the Olympics has more often been a tool of propaganda than a lever of reform. Mitt Romney, U.S. Senator, in a March 15 New York Times op-ed calling for the U.S. to enact an economic and diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing, while still sending athletes to compete. "The whole family is saddened to learn the full extent of how challenging the last few years have been for Harry and Meghan. Buckingham Palace in a statement issued on behalf of Queen Elizabeth II, March 9, in response to the couple's interview with Oprah Winfrey. "My legs were shaking because it's been so long," Benedict Garcia, 85-year-old resident of a Spanish care home, on the first time in months he and a group of seniors took a trip outside after receiving COVID vaccinations, in a March 15 interview with the AP. 28, total number of Grammys won by Beyoncé after she took home 4 at the 2021 ceremony, March 14, becoming the most decorated woman in the history of the award. Good news of the week. On March 16, Israeli archaeologists revealed dozens of new Dead Sea Scroll fragments containing nearly 2,000-year-old biblical text. The discovery will help researchers further understand the history of Judaism and early Christianity. The brief opener. Politics, Biden's Huge Wager by Alana Abramson. After one of the rockiest transitions in U.S. history, Joe Biden's term has gotten off to a brisk start. In his first 50 days, the president has muscled a massive relief bill through Congress, sending stimulus checks to millions of Americans and easing housing costs, student loans, and health insurance premiums. His team of government veterans has also executed a series of less visible but consequential moves. From increasing vaccine production to approving loans for multitudes of struggling small businesses, now Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are traveling the country, hoping to capitalize on the popularity of the plan. Biden has a 60% approval rating, according to a poll released March 5 by the APNORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, compared with about 41% for Donald Trump around this time in his presidency. "It is going to bring immediate relief," Biden said of the stimulus bill during a visit to a floor installation and supply business in Chester, Pennsylvania, March 16. "The administration will need all the public support it can muster," the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan squeaked through Congress without a single Republican vote, casting doubt on Biden's campaign pledge to build bipartisanship, which his detractors are weaponizing. To his allies, Biden's Hill win shows his political savvy. But the slim margin of passage on a broadly popular bill does not necessarily bode well for his coming battles. Democrats are heralding the COVID-19 relief bill as the biggest expansion to the social safety net in at least half a century. It delivers $1,400 stimulus checks, extends $300 weekly unemployment insurance payments, and gives many families an expanded $3,000 child tax credit. Nonpartisan experts say these provisions will bolster lower and middle income Americans who have suffered disproportionately from the economic effects of the pandemic. An analysis from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center found the bill will boost income for Americans in the lowest quintile by 20% in 2021. Most of the bill's most generous measures last only a year or two. The administration's moves to increase vaccine production and prop up small businesses will help, too. When Biden took office, the 7-day average of shots administered had not yet cracked 1 million. By the beginning of March, it had surpassed 2 million. Some 72 million Americans, including almost 65% of those over 65, had received at least one dose of the vaccine as of March 16, and 2,200 military staff have mobilized to support community vaccine sites, according to the White House. The administration's actions around vaccinations have increased the vaccination rate, says Eric Toner, a senior scholar with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. On the economic front, Biden modified the Trump administration's Paycheck Protection Program to prioritize the smallest businesses, which had struggled to access potentially forgivable loans as larger companies jumped to the front of the line. February 24, Biden set a 14-day period when only businesses and nonprofits with fewer than 20 employees could apply for relief. More than 400,000 businesses had been approved for aid as of March 7, according to the Small Business Administration, which runs the program. With loans to minority-owned businesses up 20% from the previous 10-day period and women-owned businesses up 14%. Biden's allies say he's done as much as he could, as fast as he could, but that raises questions about the tough road ahead. In the short term, he faces a surge of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border that critics say has been fueled in part by Biden's reversal of some of Trump's controversial immigration policies. Border crossings have spiked since Biden took office. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said it encountered 100,441 individuals attempting to cross the southern border in February 2021, a 28% increase from January. While the administration says the vast majority of adult migrants are being turned away, it is declining to expel children arriving without parents, and officials at the border are running out of resources to house them. Already, Hill Democrats are skeptical. They have the votes for an ambitious immigration proposal to fix the underlying causes of the periodic border crises. And Biden's campaign promises to fix climate change and address systemic racism may be even tougher to achieve. But the president's aides and allies say the political boost from his relief bill and the increased pace of vaccinations give him momentum to deliver on his agenda. It is a big accomplishment that I think will set the tone for his administration, says Delaware Senator Chris Coons, a Biden protege who occupies the president's former Senate seat. This is a very popular bill nationally, and I think it will only become more popular once Americans start feeling its impact. This was written by Alana Abramson with reporting by Jasmine Aguilera, Los Angeles, and Brian Bennett and W.J. Hennigan, Washington. From The Brief, United Kingdom, a woman's killing ignites fury across the U.K. This is by Sue Yin Haynes. She was just walking home. Those five words trended widely on social media and appeared on many tributes at a vigil for Sarah Everard, 33, a marketing executive who disappeared from a London street March 3. A week later, Everard's body was found in Woodlands in nearby Kent. And March 12, an officer with London's Metropolitan Police was charged with Everard's kidnapping and murder. Women's safety. Everard's disappearance prompted an outpouring from women in Britain sharing their own experiences of harassment on social media and assault. Everard's body was discovered the same day that a new survey by UN Women UK revealed that more than 70% of women of all ages in the country said they had experienced sexual harassment in a public space. Some 95% of respondents said they had not reported incidents of sexual harassment, with 45% saying it would not change anything. At what started as a peaceful vigil for Everard, March 13, eyewitnesses observed police brutality as several women were pushed to the ground and manhandled by officers. The Metropolitan Police said four people were arrested. Combined with the existing lack of trust in the fact that the person charged with Everard's murder is a police officer, the event sparked further fury toward police authorities. Campaigners say officers' actions at the vigil are emblematic of a much longer history of over-policing and at protests. Images and videos of the heavy-handed policing drew attention to a controversial bill that UK lawmakers voted to pass March 16, which will expand policing powers and increase restrictions on protests. Human rights groups call the legislation an attack on some of the most fundamental rights of citizens. From News Ticker column, here are three short items. Japan's gay marriage ban challenged. A Japanese court ruled for the first time March 17 that the country's same-sex marriage ban violates Japan's constitution. While the ruling did not overturn the law, advocates hope the moral victory will help pave the way for legalization. FEMA agents sent to U.S.-Mexico border. The Biden administration directed the Federal Emergency Management Agency, March 14, to help safely receive, shelter, and transfer unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. CBS News reported March 16 that more than 13,000 migrant children are currently in U.S. custody. Brazil's health minister replaced again. As COVID-19 deaths in Brazil again reached record-breaking levels, President Jair Bolsonaro said March 15 he would replace the country's health minister, an army general, with no health care experience, with Marcelo Quiroga, head of the Brazilian Society of Cardiology. Quiroga, that's Q-U-E-I-R-O-G-A, will be the fourth person in the role since last April. From the brief news, why are women taking to the streets across Australia? When Janine Hendry, H-E-N-D-R-Y, began organizing a protest against reported sexual violence in Australia's parliament, she thought just a few of her friends would turn up. But March 15, tens of thousands of protesters, mostly women, gathered in more than 40 towns and cities across the country. Black-clad demonstrators held signs reading, "Women deserve better," and "Enough is enough." The catalyst was the allegation by former political staffer Brittany Higgins that she was raped in Government Minister Linda Reynolds' office by a male co-worker in 2019. Higgins said she reported the alleged attack to her bosses but decided not to make a formal police complaint because she feared losing her job. February 15, she went public in a TV interview. Prime Minister Scott Morrison apologized for Higgins' treatment, but also sparked anger when he said that it had taken a conversation with his wife to find clarity on the situation. Reynolds, now the defense minister, admitted calling Higgins a lying cow in front of staff after the allegations became public. Morrison's center-right government is also under pressure to investigate a woman's allegation that Attorney General Christian Porter raped her in 1988. Porter has denied the assault, and the woman died by suicide in June 2020. Police dropped the investigation because of insufficient admissible evidence, and Morrison has rejected calls for an independent inquiry. Hendry, 58, says the groundswell of anger from women is driven not only by the government's response, but also by their personal experiences with sexism and inequality. Although Australia is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, it ranks 44th out of 153 nations in the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index. We fundamentally recognize the system is broken. The glass ceiling is still in place. and there are significant failings in the power structures within our institutions, Higgins told a crowd in the capital, Canberra, during the protest. Organizers delivered a petition with more than 90,000 signatures to Parliament, demanding accountability for the alleged misconduct in the halls of power and calling for structural changes to address gender inequality. Many women hope the protests will mark a watershed moment. I have not seen the women of Australia this angry before, says Hendry, 58. But that anger is actually being harnessed into something, which is going to create real change. That article was written by Amy Gunia. Three more short articles here under the news ticker. France returns art sold under Nazi rule. France's culture minister said March 15 the country would return a masterpiece by Austrian artist Gustav Klimt from its national collection to the heirs of Nora Stiazny. Stiazny, an Austrian Jewish woman, was forced to sell the painting to survive Nazi rule in 1938. She later died in the Holocaust. Biden backs filibuster reform. Amid increased calls to end the Senate's filibuster rule, President Biden said in an ABC News interview March 16 that he supports returning to the talking filibuster, which requires senators to speak continuously on the floor to delay a bill, halting all other business in the chamber. Vatican, no same-sex union blessings. While calling for LGBTQ people to be treated with respect and sensitivity, the Vatican's doctrinal watchdog said March 15 that Catholic priests cannot bless same-sex unions. Priests have asked for clarity on the issue in recent years after a push by Pope Francis for assistance for LGBTQ Catholics. Under milestones, died Goodwill Zwelithini, and that is the name of a person. The last name is spelled Zwelithini, Zwelithini. The living embodiment of Zulu culture, King Goodwill Zwelithini KaBekuZulu, leader of South Africa's largest ethnic group, died March 12 of complications related to COVID-19 at the age of 72. A direct descendant of the Zulu warrior kings who fought against colonialism, King Zwelithini played a largely ceremonial role in post-apartheid South Africa, but carried immense weight among the country's 11 million members of the Zulu nation, along with those who would court their votes. While many South Africans hailed him as the custodian of Zulu traditions, others criticized him for seemingly clinging to outdated ideas, particularly on women's role in modern society. In 1991, he reinstated the traditional reed dance, honoring female virginity, after it had been banned by the apartheid government, and defended the call for a return to morality as an appropriate cultural response to the HIV epidemic then ravaging the nation. Accused at times of appealing to ethnic nationalism in pursuit of tradition, King Zwelithini nonetheless managed to demonstrate to all his fellow South Africans that a modern country thrives when its roots are sunk deep in the past and not forgotten in the present day. That article was written by Aaron, A-R-Y-N, Baker. Announced an impeachment inquiry by New York State lawmakers March 11 into allegations of sexual harassment by Governor Andrew Cuomo and criticism of his handling of COVID-19 nursing home death numbers. Arrested, two men, March 14, for allegedly assaulting Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick with an unknown chemical spray during the January 6 Capitol riots. Sicknick died the following day from his injuries. Performed. Famed classical cellist Yo-Yo Ma for onlookers at Berkshire Community College in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, as he waited the required 15 minutes after receiving his second COVID-19 vaccine shot, March 13. Died, Norton Juster, author known for his children's book The Phantom Toll Booth, March 8, at 91. Yaphet Kotto, actor known for his roles in a variety of films including Alien and Live and Let Die, March 15, at 81. James Levine, the Met Opera conductor, perhaps he pronounced that Levine, the Met Opera conductor who was fired in 2018 over allegations of sexual abuse, March 9, at 77. Backed, a law that would create France's first age of consent for sexual relations, setting the age of consent at 15 and banning sex with relatives under 18 by French MPs. The bill is also expected to pass the French Senate. The final item on this page of milestones is a bit longer. It does feature a photograph of a woman dressed in black. It looks like a black winter coat. She also has long black hair. She's wearing earrings, silver it looks like, and she has a beige or ivory scarf around her neck. She's standing in front of the Capitol Dome, so the contrast of color and lack thereof in this photo is striking. The Capitol Dome is also superimposed against a light gray-white background. Perhaps it was a cloudy day or a snowy day, but the contrasts are in black, white, and off-white coloration. It says here, confirmed, Deb Haaland, H-A-A-L-A-N-D, and it is indeed Representative Haaland, pictured outside the U.S. Capitol January 4, 2019. Deb Haaland, lawmaker of the land. Born in Winslow, Arizona in 1960, a time when there were still Native Americans who could not vote in the U.S., former U.S. Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico was confirmed by the Senate March 15 as the country's first Native American cabinet secretary. A member of the Laguna Pueblo, Haaland will serve as President Biden's Secretary of the Interior, overseeing an agency responsible for public lands, waterways, wildlife, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, among other responsibilities. There's a long history of Native women acting as advocates for their lands. After the gold rush in the mid-19th century, Paiute activist Sarah Winnemucca traveled nationwide to promote the importance of protecting tribal rights and to raise awareness about violence in the American West. Native Americans are hopeful that Haaland will incorporate an understanding of tribal nations' century-old practices into future approaches to combating climate change. A staunch opponent of fracking, Haaland was also an early supporter of the Green New Deal, calling for the U.S. to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, but stressed during her confirmation hearings that she will be carrying out Biden's agenda in her role, not necessarily her own. If an indigenous woman from humble beginnings can be confirmed as Secretary of the Interior, she tweeted March 4, our country and its promise still holds true for everyone. And that was written by Olivia B. Waxman. The Brief Nation in the Chauvin Case, A Nightmare Replayed by Janelle Ross, Chauvinist, spelled C-H-A-U-V-I-N. There's a photo here. It's basically a chain-link fence, and interwoven within the links of chain are flowers, yellow, peach, pink, red, white. And there's a poster posted on the chain-link fence saying, "Justice for Floyd." And it has a photograph of George Floyd on the poster. There are stories that we tell, and there are stories that we keep until we can't. Kelly Burns, 36, is a college administrator and married suburban Chicago mom. Online, she posts about her son's bowling skills and, for her daughter, reminders about Girl Scout cookie season. When Burns mentions her father, she describes herself as a daddy's girl until he passed away suddenly when she was 18. What she thought she would never share is that in 2002, a Minneapolis police officer compressed her father's neck until he died. Less than 2 miles from where a different police officer pressed George Floyd into the pavement nearly 20 years later, the medical examiner ruled her father's death a homicide. There was no trial. "I've been contemplating if I was going to post this or not," Burns wrote on Instagram in May 2020 as footage of Floyd's death became public. She was sharing what only her husband and a few others knew, but this one hit hard. "This is not the first time Minneapolis police have done this. My father, Christopher Burns, died just like this innocent black male killed in the hands of Minneapolis, Minnesota police in 2002. As the world awaits the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former officer charged with killing Floyd, some, like Burns, know that more often than not, justice eludes the families of those killed by police. Criminal charges for police officers aren't rare, and convictions extraordinary. In a typical year, about 1,000 people are shot to death by police in the U.S. From January 2005 to March 11, 2021, just 138 law enforcement officers have been charged with murder or manslaughter for on-duty shootings, according to an analysis prepared for Time by Philip Stinson, a professor of criminal justice who also directs the Henry A. Wallace Police Crime Database at Bowling Green State University. Of the 138 officers, 44 have been convicted. Stinson identified at least 10 additional officers charged because of chokehold deaths between January 2005 and February 2021. One was convicted of civil rights violations and another of falsifying reports. Chauvin has been charged with second-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter, and third-degree murder, a charge that was reinstated March 11 after it was initially dismissed. Prosecutors have argued the additional charge will increase the odds of conviction, but it carries a shorter prison term than second-degree murder. Jury selection began March 9, and opening statements are scheduled for March 29. In the Burns case, police were responding to a loud argument at the apartment where Burns' girlfriend was staying. Officers said they forced their way into the house after Burns insisted they were not needed. Lisa Burns, who was 3 years old, was in the room when her father died. Lisa said, and she does not remember this today, "They killed my daddy, they killed my daddy," Kelly Burns said. Before the funeral, she says she learned that two of Burns' teeth had been knocked out and bones in his neck broken. As she would in multiple cases involving black men killed by police in Minneapolis, Hennepin County's then chief prosecutor, now Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar, declined to use her power to indict. A grand jury also refused to indict. It is not an unusual scenario, and one reason may be that American juries often do not look much like America. Patrick Bayer, an economist at Duke University, studies racial inequality and segregation. In his latest research, Bayer and his co-authors examined data from 2,400 felony trials conducted from 2005 to 2012 in Harris County, Texas, which includes Houston. They found that people from predominantly white and affluent suburban neighborhoods were overrepresented in jury pools, resulting in juries that looked little like the people living in and around the nation's fourth largest city. They were more likely to receive jury summonses by mail because many did not move as frequently as lower-income renters, whose jury notices often went to outdated addresses. Overrepresentation from those suburban zip codes increased the median sentence handed down to black defendants by more than 50%, the research concluded. In Hennepin County, which includes Minneapolis, white Americans make up 68% of residents, according to the most recent census data, but 80% of the jury pool in fiscal year 2020. Black residents were 13.8% of the population, but 8.2% of the jury pool. Finances also contribute to the racial disparity, says Andrew Gordon, a defense lawyer in Minneapolis and deputy director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center, a nonprofit law firm. Jurors get $20 a day for their service, and most states, including Minnesota, do not require employers to pay workers on jury duty. It does not put food on the table, and it does not pay rent, Gordon says, of the daily stipend. If you've ever been to downtown Minneapolis, that may not even cover your parking. Chauvin's lawyers have a difficult challenge. They must explain Chauvin's refusal to remove his knee and render first aid. There's also Chauvin's flat affect during Floyd's final moments. Prosecutors face an arguably more complex task: to convince 12 jurors that Chauvin acted unreasonably or with insufficient regard for Floyd's life, they must also accomplish what the video of his death did for those who protested: get the white people on the jury, who are more likely to describe their encounters with police as positive, to sympathize with a large black man rather than the officer confronting him. Those are skills they, prosecutors, don't necessarily have, says trial consultant Diane Wiley. They are usually on the side of the police. Wiley's president of the National Jury Project, a firm founded after she and colleagues consulted on a 1974 trial involving Native American activists Russell Means and Dennis Banks, who occupied Wounded Knee, South Dakota. A judge eventually dismissed the charges. Wiley has seen few prosecutors who can get white jurors past stereotypes about danger and race. In the Chauvin trial, even though Floyd is the victim, it will be no small task. In this country, says Gordon, part of the constructs and narratives of being a black man is that you have superhuman strength. You're capable of hurting people, not because you are fighting or resisting, but black. Gordon doubts the defense will say that so plainly. Floyd's drug use, criminal record, and size will be the story told. No one on the defense has to say it, says Gordon. They can let it, the stereotypes, do their unconscious work. In police trials, dueling expert testimony is often presented. In the Chauvin case, there are autopsies with different findings, and the disputed concept of excited delirium has already surfaced in pretrial paperwork. The condition and its ability to cause sudden death in agitated people is often the basis of officers' claims that overwrought individuals had to be restrained with great force for their own good. For Christopher Burns, 82-year-old mother Ann Burns, the Floyd case is just like a nightmare reappearing. The experts said Christopher Burns, 44, was combative and violent and had to be contained. The family was told her handcuffed son reached for an officer's gun, prompting them to put him in a chokehold, a maneuver Minneapolis police finally banned last June. To her, the police version made no sense. It still does not. It is among the reasons Kelly Burns began talking to her son about policing and racism when he was just 8 years old. Ann Burns' house is sprinkled with pictures of Christopher, graduating from high school in his 20s, holding baby Kelly at family gatherings in his 30s and 40s. He was a reliable son and a certified nursing assistant who helped care for his father after a stroke, his mother says. He was a dad who taught Lisa how to ride a bike and drive a car, she says. The last time she saw him, he was boarding a bus in Chicago, where he'd been living, taking little Lisa back to her mom in Minneapolis. Minneapolis paid Burns' family $300,000, but it was not the justice they wanted. The officer involved in Burns' death, Lucas Peterson, is still on the force. He has been named in at least 12 other excessive force settlements. "That's why I have to pray," says Ann Burns. "I have to pray that justice will be done for any other case that comes up, for anybody else that has to go through this, and for peace of mind so that I will be able to sleep at night." This is with reporting by Leslie Dickstein, written by Janelle Ross, and there's a small inset photo here of the Burns family. Christopher in a 1990s family photo with his mother, two sisters, and daughter Kelly in the front. And these are people of color. The brief health safety checks AstraZeneca's vaccine woes by Alice Park. It's the last thing public health officials want to see during a pandemic, more than 2 months after scientists from pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca and Oxford University released their COVID-19 vaccine, a growing number of countries are pausing its use. The stop page comes after a small number of reports of blood clots, some of them fatal, among those who have received the two-dose shot. It is not clear yet whether the blood clots are related to the shot, but leaders in countries like France, Germany, and Indonesia are not taking any chances. "What we are seeing is a domino effect," says Dr. Anna Durbin, professor of international health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. "Nobody wants to be the country that did not stop vaccinating and then find out that the side effects are really related." The European Medicines Agency, EMA, which oversees drugs and vaccines in Europe, is investigating the reports, but now says the benefits of the vaccine outweigh any potential risks. In a statement, AstraZeneca supported that position, noting that among the 17 million people who've been vaccinated with its shot in the UK and EU so far, there was no evidence of an increased risk of clots in any defined age group, gender, batch, or in any particular country. In fact, the blood clots have been reported in just dozens of the millions of AstraZeneca vaccine recipients. So why the mass movement away from using the vaccine? In part, issues with AstraZeneca's late-stage human testing made people wary of the company's shot even before the clotting reports emerged. Public health experts found the data from the company's Phase 3 trial, which were used to gain authorization in the UK, hard to interpret, because changes were made after the trial began in both the size of doses people received and the timing of the shots. Dosing the stakes meant some participants received a half dose and then a full dose instead of two full doses 1 month apart, while others ended up waiting 3 months for their second shot because of supply delays. Still, the AstraZeneca vaccine was approved for use across Europe and elsewhere around the world, and it is unclear if any of the issues with the trial would have affected the shot's safety or efficacy. Whether wise or not, the decisions to suspend use of AstraZeneca's vaccine could further slow mass vaccination across the EU, where only about 10% of the population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine so far. Dr. Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a member of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, adds that the stoppages may seed more doubt about the safety and efficacy of all coronavirus vaccines. When you scare people, it's hard to unscare them, he says. If AstraZeneca's shot stays on the sidelines for long, it could hamper the battle against COVID-19 far beyond Europe. The company has promised large supplies of its vaccine to countries in need, in part through the global COVAX, C-O-V-A-X program. While other manufacturers have made similar commitments, public health experts say the world will need every dose it can get to end the pandemic as quickly as possible. 37 is the number of reported clotting-related events among AstraZeneca vaccine recipients, and 17 million is the number of people vaccinated with AstraZeneca's shot across the UK and EU. There's a photo here. It shows mostly two gloved hands. There is a face in the background, but it's blurred out because one of the hands is holding a hypodermic syringe, or I guess that's what you call them. It's the thing that's used to give vaccinations. It's a syringe of some kind. And the other's holding a little vial, a little small glass jar or container of COVID-19 vaccine. It's a vial of AstraZeneca vaccine. March 9 in Milan, Italy, where it has since suspended use. That is, Italy has. COVID criminals. Black market shots. As governments rush to vaccinate their citizens against COVID-19, organized crime groups are seeking to exploit weaknesses in the global vaccine supply chain, fueling a parallel pandemic of crime that has generated billions of dollars in illegal profits, according to the global police agency Interpol. These crime types were following the virus around the world. Jürgen Stock, Interpol Secretary or General Secretary, tells Time, "I've never seen such a dynamic situation before." At the start of the pandemic, criminal groups focused on the trade in counterfeit masks, disinfectants, and COVID-19 testing kits. But some of the newest scams Interpol is now tracking across its 194 member countries are seeking profit from COVID-19 vaccines, either by stealing real vaccines and trying to sell them on the black market, Stock says, or by marketing fake shots that could prove dangerous to public health. March 3, the agency revealed the first confirmed case of fake vaccines being trafficked between continents, an organized group in China that has allegedly filled ampoules with 2,400 doses of a saline solution before smuggling them to South Africa to be sold as COVID-19 vaccines. More than 80 people were arrested for their participation in the scheme. One of the clearest patterns Stock has noticed in tracking such criminal networks over the past year is how quickly they learn from one another. What today pops up in one part of the world will tomorrow be in the rest, he says. The best way to counter such activity, he adds, is through greater coordination among national police agencies. No country, no region can fight this type of crime in isolation. Simon Schuster wrote that article. Next, there is a two-page photograph here under the heading Light Box. The photograph is by Yuichi Yamazaki, Getty Images. There's a man kneeling among frothy waves. He's dressed in a white robe, which is cinched at his waist with a pale purple or lavender belt. He's holding golden beads in his hands, which are clasped in prayer. His head is bent. He's mostly bald, but not quite. There are others standing behind him, approximately knee-deep in the water, where the surf is smooth. They're also wearing white robes, and most of them have been tucked up so that they're not drooping into the water. Behind them stands additional people who are clothed as if it's a chilly day. They're on the sandy beach. All are wearing long pants, jeans, brown pants, casual-looking trousers. Some are wearing jackets. They're kind of blurry here in the distance, blue and brown, dark-colored jackets. Most are wearing masks, perhaps all. Now, the men in the water are not wearing masks, but most of the bystanders are. Some, it appears, are holding cameras to their faces. Behind that are fences, trees, hills with more trees, a few scattered houses or buildings here and there. They may not be houses. Perhaps there's a train, a short, maybe commuter train in the far background, and power lines. And the caption reads, "Remembering Fukushima." A Buddhist monk prays at a beach in Iwaki, Japan, for victims of the March 11, 2011, earthquake and tsunami on the 10th anniversary of the disaster. The magnitude 9.0 earthquake, one of the strongest on record, caused a tsunami that slammed into Japan's northeastern coast. Waves more than 30 feet high destroyed entire towns and caused nuclear reactor meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. Nearly 20,000 people died in the disaster, and more than 40,000 are still unable to return to home because of high radiation levels around the nuclear facility. COVID questions. We're trying to make living through the pandemic a little easier with expert-backed answers to your toughest coronavirus-related dilemmas. That's what Time says. Josh asks, I'm 23 years old and split time at home and out of state for work. While I was out of state, my entire family got vaccinated and at this point have gotten both doses. That leaves me as the only one not vaccinated. How concerned should I be about them transmitting the virus to me? Time says, researchers are growing confident that vaccination lowers someone's chances of infecting others, although they do not know by how much. With the caveat that nothing in life is 100% guaranteed, you probably do not need to worry about catching the virus from your family, says Dr. Philip Landrigan, an epidemiologist at Boston College. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says fully vaccinated people can now safely gather unmasked at home with a small group of other vaccinated people and can visit unmasked with a limited number of unvaccinated people, assuming none has risk factors for severe disease. To be cautious, you and your relatives could wear masks around the house until you're also vaccinated, but if you're healthy overall, you are probably not at high risk. Vaccine passports. This is an article by Aaron Baker, and it may be abridged for time purposes. Europe plans for post-pandemic travel. In a move welcomed by many of the bloc's beleaguered travel destinations, EU leadership is considering a digital health pass that would allow EU citizens who have received a COVID-19 vaccine to travel for work or tourism. Some airlines are already requiring proof of COVID vaccination or recovery for international flights. Certain cruise lines are demanding similar documentation. Israel, which as of March 17 had fully vaccinated 49% of its population, has already implemented a program that allows vaccinated people access to gyms, concerts, and hotels. Denmark has also announced plans for a digital health passport. But vaccine passports will be vital for economies reeling from lockdowns and travel restrictions, says Anthony Dworkin, senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Some element of unfairness is the price we have to pay for a kind of partial reopening. Regardless, until vaccines are universally available, social distancing and other protective measures will still be needed. A vaccine passport alone will not bring us back to normal, says Femenia Serra, adding that tourists still need to behave in the right way, because if we don't, there's another disaster waiting for us after the summer's over. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.